And then we sort of start at a certain point counting actual years. So it's a little bit of sort of trying to go back and figure out how far back do we go. So some people might believe that the world started 5,779 years ago, if you have a really literal interpretation. Vast majority of Jews on the planet, 99.9%, do not believe that. They believe in evolution. So this is our what we say, how we count time together as a people, not for all of creation. So around the time that Jesus was born, in the year 72 of the Common Era. And so sometimes in Christian circles, we call things a little bit differently than in Jewish circles. Instead of saying before Christ and after Christ, we say the Common Era or before the Common Era. Of course, the Common Era is the Christian era. So in 72 of the Common Era, meaning after the year zero, is when what I call T2 happened, which is the Second Temple was destroyed. Up until that time, the way that the Israelite religion was practiced, you might be familiar with it because it's described in the Christian Bible, where there was the temple in Jerusalem, all the stairs going up and down, and there were priests. Those priests were ordained, according to the tradition, in the book of Exodus, coming out of Egypt as a slave population to a free population. The whole religious system is established with Aaron as being the high priest, and all who for descend from him forevermore should be the priests. Well, by this point, it could have been thousands of years of this. What happens in families when it's hereditary for thousands of years? What do we know about human history? If we look at like every other example that's ever existed about hereditary leadership, right, it's bad. It's a good humanity. We don't, you know, hereditary leadership usually is not good. It usually has been overthrown all over the world. What happened here at Second Temple times is it had been corrupted. It was not a healthy system. It had been going on for thousands of years, and it involved the mass slaughter of animals. Our primary way of communicating with God at this point was through animal sacrifice. And so if you sin, animal sacrifice. If you're happy, animal sacrifice. Except it was such a huge system that it was money changing and this and that. Long story short, there were other Israelites at that time period who knew that this was not sustainable. And they started at that time period praying and practicing what would become Judaism in a different way. Jesus was probably one of those people, was one of those rabbis. There were other rabbis too, and they started to pray together in these four-sided rooms. You can go to them in northern Israel and see where the early synagogues were, the early gathering places, of people facing each other in prayer, people praying starting three times a day instead of doing the three sacrifices at the temple. They were starting to mirror that in their prayers, and starting to really focus on studying Torah. And Torah became the focus, and it was happening naturally. The priesthood and the whole system, the temple, was crumbling apart. So the Romans destroy the Second Temple, and we have to reboot as a people. What do you do when that's basically been the way that you've been doing things for a really long time, the dominant culture way? And the rabbis are there to step in and say, we're ready to lead. Our Judaism, this new thing that's emerging from the rebels of the Second Temple, is now based on study of Torah, avodah, which means service, which is what they used, the verb that was used for the priests to do the priestly service. It now means prayer, and gemilut chasadim, acts of love and kindness. That's what Judaism is going to be moving forward. So that's around that Second Temple, right after Second Temple period. If you keep going down in the history timeline, as Christianity is emerging and flourishing and growing, Judaism starts to do this thing that we'll see happen as a cycle over and over again, which is when we feel strong and stable and safe, we open up like a flower. But when the surrounding environments are hostile, we shut down like a hedgehog or an armadillo trying to protect itself with a hard shell. A lot of what's happened in the hard shell time was study and a deep, deep focus on Jewish text. It was almost like playing a video game where if you just can focus on this way of understanding the world, this logic system, this legal system, and getting deep, deep into the texts, and pop your head up to eat and sleep, maybe we can survive some dark times. And that's how we got the Talmud, is a period of going in and insular to study and become very sort of focused on our own texts and traditions. So the other day someone asked me about, like, how does Judaism approach Jesus? And the answer is we don't. Because during that time period, when Jesus was becoming the focus of a new and ever-growing religion, Jews were now like this, focused inward, and they did not talk about Jesus at all in the text. I think the Talmud mentions Jesus twice, and it's like volumes and volumes. And I think that's telling. Why, you know, because they were so turning inward that there wasn't a sense of talking about the outside world as much. They do talk about Greek and Roman stuff, but it's in the past. It's not their reality. They're reflecting on a different reality in their study. So around the year 600 is when the Talmud is codified, which means it's actually like written down as opposed to just being conversations. Does anybody have any questions up to this point? Do you have a sense of sort of like what Jewish or Israelite history was sort of from zero going backwards to whatever we consider the beginning to be? Yes.
Prominent was the messianic hope and looking for a Messiah.
Oh, how prominent was it? It was very prominent during this year zero time. So it was because that was at the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes, the story of Masada. It was a very intense cultural time, a lot of darkness, and a lot of sectarianism. So if we can look at other times in human history and think about what was it like when a society was under a lot of pressure, there was a great deal of sectarianism, and that institution that had been sitting there, the temple, for so long, I mean, it was rebuilt after 586 before the Common Era. Remember, this is T2. There was a T1. So it had been rebuilt and used for like 500 years. I mean, think about our government, our capital in the United States, how long it's been there. What would happen if it was blown up, God forbid, poo-poo-poo? Like, what would happen? I mean, how would we feel about our society?
Yeah.
We'd be flipping out, you know, like, what is the, you know, is the Constitution valid? Like, what's going on? How are we going to
move? All of our representatives, senators, and congressmen were there, would be good.
Amen.
Imagine being in a situation where you have to reboot your whole civilization, which is what America would have to do if our government was destroyed. So the Jewish people were faced with that challenge. We've been faced with it before because the temple was destroyed in 586, and we were exiled, at least the elite, to Babylonia. And so that was another, that was the first time we were sort of in exile. Remember, as we go back, there's King David, the monarchy, the actual building of the temple in Jerusalem, which wasn't necessarily prescribed in the first place, but they really wanted a king and a centralized location. Then we go back to the 12 tribes going in, we go back to the wandering for 40 years, to the Exodus, to the tribes, to creation. So that's our trajectory backwards. Forwards. Yes, go ahead.
The major force causing the armadillo reaction around 600?
Well, I think it was being so severely in a diaspora and spread out all over so that we were more concentrated before, and now we've sort of had like 500 years of being spread out and being very small minority groups, and with lots of expulsions and being pushed around. I mean, the arc of all this until basically like 1900 is expulsions, pogroms, moving from one place to another, for Jews in Europe, for European Jewry. So if you went to France or Spain or what was Germany, none of those countries existed at the time. You had a very tough couple thousand years there, where it was just a lot of moving around.
Who's responsible for the expulsions and pogroms and things like that?
Well, usually it was the Christian population that was living there, because at that time period, there was a, you know, there was a belief that, the best I've heard it described is that, why do Jews still exist? That's sort of the question. Like, if Jesus is the Messiah, then why do Jews continue to exist? And imagine if you were so much closer to that Jesus era than we are now. Jews stand as a sign and a witness of people not accepting Jesus. And so it became this idea that we are the witness people, we're here for the world to witness our suffering and not accepting Jesus. So it's sort of like the whipping post for the universe to see, to say, like, if you don't accept and you don't follow this way, this is the suffering that you will endure. But I think having a religion that stems from, you know, that Christianity stems from, but kept going on its own trajectory, really just like not paying attention to Jesus and then not having anything to do with the tradition, it was very hard to manage, clearly. I mean, clearly, that was really hard to balance together. It's like, why are these people here? Why do they still exist? This shouldn't be happening. So we have the Talmud here, and that what the Talmud does is it helps Jews all over the world know how to live together as a community. Because how is it that we kept our identity all together while we were living in France and Finland and India, and Jews were in Uganda, all over the world? And part of it was, at least for European Jewry, is that they started, their rabbis started talking to each other, and they started making decisions, basically, about how things should be done and how we practice all together. And we've been able to maintain some worldwide norms and practices for the Jewish people, that even though we've been separated for so long. So some of those are ritual circumcision, is universal, and maintained in populations that didn't even know about each other for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Sabbath, having a Sabbath day. Some of the rules of keeping kosher, especially the ones that are laid out most clearly in the Bible. And some of the biblical holidays, especially the ones where animal sacrifices were involved, like Yom Kippur and Passover. So some of the biblical holidays. So for a very long time, we were held together by certain practices and customs across space and time. And what we would call this is the diaspora era, because in 1948, according to our history, came back. If you were exiled in the year 72, according to our story, in 1948, we come back to Israel and we're no longer in the diaspora. We're no longer living in Galut. As you all know, right before 1948, a lot of really horrible stuff happened and had been happening for a very long time to Jewish people in Europe. And so 6 million Jews were killed within a period of 8 years. And that's a very, very short time period to kill that many people. It was very intense. And the Jewish peoples, to this day, we still are processing what that means. It hasn't been that long. But before that, there was so much bloodshed. You know, it's like it's hard for me to even believe when I read the history that there were 6 million Jews to kill, because there was so much bloodshed before that. And the book that I find most helpful for the history of anti-Semitism is called Anguish of the Jews. It's written by a priest, so it's coming from a Christian perspective, but he doesn't pull any punches in describing sort of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of ongoing persecution and bloodshed. And I was just reading, actually, a poem that someone wrote, I think, about either Easter or Christmas. But, you know, the inherited memory that I have from my European side of the family is that Christmas and Easter are the most dangerous days of the year for Jews. Because after people would get out of church, they would go on pogroms. And so Jews would nail up their windows and doors on those holidays to keep people from coming in and hurting them. And that's our collective memory about, you know, the holidays were very joyous, I know now, for Christians in this country. But it's been a very fast turnaround. It's been just a couple hundred years of that. So the vast majority of the people who came to this country around 1900 from Europe, who were Jewish, were coming fleeing persecution. And also fleeing mandatory conscription by Tsarist Russia. So they came here to find it, to be free, to have a country where they're free from religious persecution. And by and large, that is, I mean, better than any other place we've ever lived. I mean, America, hands down. I mean, I'm here. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. And while we have a problem with white supremacists and neo-Nazis, they're still a small fringe group. It's unfortunate that they exist, but it's not by and large the majority of Christians that are in the Northwest. So this is the diaspora period. The experience of Jews who lived in Muslim countries is very different than the experience of Jews who lived in Christian countries because they were a protected status in Islam. And so even though it wasn't equal, it was protected, and that meant that their lifestyle and their freedom to be part of the society was very, very good up until 1948, and then Israel's relationship with the Arab world really changed that. So a lot of Jews, including my family, left Muslim countries and went to Israel because the laws were becoming more restrictive. And actually, in my mother's case, immigration to Israel was forbidden by Morocco, and so they left illegally and went through France to Israel. And then eventually some of the family came here after that. So does anybody have any questions about this piece, about timeline? Yes?
Back to before the Common Era,
yes.
80,
yes.
Who sent the Jews into exile at that time?
That was the Babylonians. That was the Babylonian Empire. So what they did is they kept the majority of the people who were like working the land in here. And they had a policy of bringing different populations in and out from all over their empire. And so this is actually the time period where Samaritans break off.
Yep.
Is because they started keeping a different calendar cycle. So it was all one population, but then with all that hubbub of the destruction of the first temple, the populations being mixed all together, this is also the time period where the 12 tribes were lost. So we don't have a strong association with 12 tribes after that time period. Just a lot of turmoil with the destruction of the first temple. We don't know as much about it because what comes later are the Greeks and Romans, and they're so much more intellectual in terms of their keeping of records and writings. So this time period, which is the time period also the story of Esther, is a story that takes place in Babylonia during that time period, if you want to sort of situate yourself in the text of it. So the elite were sent to Babylonia. And one thing that's interesting, that I've always found interesting, is during this time period, some went to Babylonia, some went to Egypt, to sort of the culture centers, and they each in those communities tried to build little temples.
Wow.
They attempted, we have archaeological evidence that they attempted to build small versions of this. Way back then, it didn't fly. It just didn't work. They were too close, I think. It was too close of a time period. They wanted to go back, and they wanted to rebuild what they had. And they were able to do that with King Cyrus. Was able to bring them back, rebuild the second temple. After that time period is the story of Hanukkah. That's with the Greeks, where the Greeks took over the temple, and then the Maccabees won it back. That's that whole time period. And later, around the year zero, is the Romans. So just to sort of get it, but the Greek period is in here. Does that answer? More or less, yeah, more or less. Any other questions about this? Yes?
Well, it does make me wonder about your sense of being in majority cultures through history. It sounds like there was a lot briefer times.
Yes.
Majority culture, is that right?
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, we were majority culture for a little bit of time, here. There wasn't a lot of consistent autonomy. We've been a diaspora people for most of our experience. And there's a book called The Jew and the Lotus where the Dalai Lama invites five rabbis to come to Tibet to meet with him to talk about how do you survive as a people outside of your home. And they gave him all kinds of advice. Now, what we know today about Israel is it's very hard to have power. Having power is not as easy as, and we can see that with Israel's government, is that the people who are in power there now are a generation of warriors. warriors. these are mostly men who have lived through many wars, and those are the people who are in charge of the government. And I think we sort of can imagine, like, after Vietnam, when we had, like, people, generals and warriors of our time who then get into politics, and you can see how that influences. So you can, if you imagine, well, Israel seems very warlike right now. Well, yes. The leadership, the people who are in leadership, I think that will change. I think that the generation that's coming up is the tech generation. They're all the young people of their country who are very diverse and very invested in technology and are much more worldly and less traumatized than the generation before. If everybody can have, like, enough time not to have a lot of violence, there's enough. Then hope grows if you get a respite from the violence. So 1948 was a really important year for the Jewish people because we considered ourselves no longer in exile, being able to come home. And so my mother's family, like, okay, we've been waiting. They, you know, since the destruction of the Second Temple, when we went with the Romans to Morocco and just sort of stayed there, they intermarried with Berbers, but they were there for as long as they can remember. And when they saw there was the opportunity to go back, then they, you know, you pack up your stuff and you go back. Doesn't matter how long you've been away. In part because what I think that without diving too deep into Judaism, Israel and returning to the land and this idea of being exile and wanting to go home is in almost all of our prayers. It's part of the stories we tell. It's that we're yearning for Zion. I think if you listen to Rastafarian music, you definitely hear it. You know, you can hear that return. We yearn to return to Zion, to a place where we're safe, to a place where we can really call home. So that's, I mean, that's part of the deep in the religion. So when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah in a few weeks, we're going to be dipping apples into honey, and we're going to be eating pomegranates, because those are the symbols of the new year. But really, pomegranates are what are growing on the trees in Israel. So we follow the agricultural cycle of that land through how we celebrate the holidays, wherever we live in the world, even if it's a very different agricultural cycle, because of the connection to the land itself, which makes the whole situation so much worse, because everybody has really, really deep connections, really deep, ancient, thousands and thousands of year old connections. That's real for everyone, as it is real for the native people who live in this land.
When you say everyone, you mean Palestinians, Arabs?
Everyone. Christians, the Baha'i, the Mormons who are invested in that. I mean, it seems like it's not a mistake that all the world's religions, most of the world's religions, at least Abrahamic, are all focused on one spot in the world. And the old city is very, very small. It's like, we're being told something. We're being pointed to, you know, here's, if you can't get along here, there's really no point. So I always think about Jerusalem as like the navel of the universe. And it's and that everybody is sort of ending up there in this one little space, like piled on top of each other, because we might be curious primates, but we can sometimes be dense primates too, in that not recognizing what the solution or the key is. So we're being told very explicitly, get along or else it's not going to go well for any of you. Any questions about that?
That's great.
All right. So I am going to go into Jewish life as it is lived and practiced. And the first thing I'm going to do is take you through the Jewish life cycle. So you're just
leaving Jerusalem and Israel-Palestinian issues, or?
Well, no, we can continue.
No,
yeah.
You didn't know if you were leaving.
If you want to talk about that more, let's do that now.
Well, we took our two daughters to Israel and the West Bank a couple of years ago. We went to Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Museum. And my family was Jewish, although I don't practice Judaism. But I remember the last thing it said was, never again.
Yeah.
And what I felt is never again to us. We can do it to somebody else, but never again to us. And that has remained very troubling to me.
Yes.
It is still very troubling.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, as we extend the timeline of Jewish history out, for me, the Jewish, the fissure that's ended up in the Jewish community with the Trump presidency really, I think, put that never again to a test. Do we mean never again just means us, or do we mean never again for anybody, and do we mean never again as now because we're able to recognize the signs of fascism rising? And what you'll see in the American Jewish community is we do have a break. About 70% of American Jews vote Democrat or liberals. So still the vast majority, but there's that 30%, and they're Trump supporters, and they have a lot of money, and they're pumping money into Republican politics, and they're also pumping money into Islamophobia, unfortunately. And so there's a break in our community, and it's hard when you're at each other's throats, but I will let you know that there is a fight going on. It's not like, no one's laying back and saying, do whatever you want. We're in a huge fight, and the vast majority of American Jews are progressive Jews. So it just means people speaking up and standing up and getting activated, and they are. But it also means having to say some really difficult things to say to our Orthodox and right-wing brothers and sisters about how we feel. And I've gotten into many, many conflicts and just receive a lot of negative mail from people because there's just a lot of tension within our own community. And I'm sure that exists within all religious communities. But I think it's fine to say that, I think the Trump presidency represents another mark in the timeline of Jewish history, that we will not be able to go back from this, that the alliance between Trump and Israel and the discomfort of the vast majority of American Jews with that alliance, it's going to mean something. I don't know, I can't predict the future, but I think that it's going to mean something big for the American Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And also, progressive Jews, by and large, are highly, highly intermarried. So I'd say 60, 70, maybe, I'd say 80%. So these are families who have part of their families, people who aren't Jewish. And people who aren't Jewish, and people who aren't white, and people of different backgrounds. And so liberal Judaism has become much, much more multicultural. And so often, the Orthodox population doesn't even see them as Jews because they're intermarried. And so if the mother's not Jewish, then they wouldn't consider them Jews in the first place. And when you start not recognizing each other is when you have problems. I'm sure, we all know that from our religious history. That we say, I don't recognize you as our religion anymore, causes big issues. So we're there. There's a lot of awesome things going on in Jewish civilization, too. And for myself, because my mother was a refugee, Israel was really the only place that they could go. And so I do consider myself a Zionist. I have to. I would be hypocritical and not thankful for those who laid the framework for my family and basically the vast majority of Moroccan Jews and the Jews of Tunisia and Algeria and Egypt and Yemen and Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran and every single Muslim country, vast majority went to Israel because of persecution. And it was because of persecution that happened starting really in 1948.
Yeah.
So there's a massive amount of Jews from Muslim countries, myself included, who consider themselves Zionists because this is where they were able to go. And we had more of a conversation about that, but I just wanted to put that out there that you might not have encountered in your experiences with American Jews who are come from Muslim countries who have always been there and sort of our history and throwing that into the pot. Yes.
So what you kind of complicated for me, and I really appreciate it, is I often hear the word Zionism in a completely negative frame.
Yes.
Right. And what you're actually kind of advocating a third position, right? From Zionism is completely good to Zionism completely bad. You're actually arguing for a very different, more nuanced view of that. So I just really interesting to me.
Well, because I think that my view comes from my real human experience, and I'm not here to promote one side or the other.
Yeah.
I, of course, believe in Palestinian self-determination and the right for them to have their own state, and they're, absolutely have been an advocate for that and a second generation advocate for that. So that's not, we've always been involved. The organizations that we're involved in are J Street and New Israel Fund, J Street is sort of like the APAC of the left, where they lobby in Washington, D.C. for a two-state solution or for some solution that's going to be leading to less bloodshed. It's like less killing. And the New Israel Fund is an organization that invests in Israeli civil society in terms of having like battered women's shelters, interfaith work that happens there, serving all women and all people in Israel, regardless of their who they are. So those are sort of, that's where I've been involved in terms of my passion for Israel, is building a stronger and healthier democracy, and of course having a healthy Palestinian state side by side, God willing. Soon may it be in our day.
Amen. I think your head there, but as far as the different types of Judaism, you talk about Orthodox Jews and where ethnicity comes into play, is that anywhere you're all headed? Like,
yeah, I'll transition over to that now. So there's Orthodox Judaism, and what that means is basically that Orthodox Judaism, it means that your Judaism is based on following Jewish law, which is called halakha, and it's essentially, its function is the same as Sharia in Islam, where it's the laws that have been debated and discussed, and this is how you're going to do it, this is how we practice it. And it's a little bit evolving because things come up, you know, like different surgeries and all kinds of stuff, so people have to keep on talking about it. And liberal Judaism does not follow halakha. What we say is it has a vote but not a veto. So in Orthodox Judaism, a woman can't be a rabbi because in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, it says that women, children, and slaves cannot serve as reliable witnesses in a court of law. Which means that you would not be a reliable witness in a for a wedding, a conversion, any kind of anything, a lot of things that I do. So liberal Judaism says that might have made sense in its time and place. It has a vote, but not a veto. We want to be egalitarian. We're not going to do that anymore. So it's just saying, like, we're not going to do that anymore. And liberal Judaism came out of 19th century German Jewry, where they were very, very educated, very assimilated. We know that that did not help them in the face of fascism. No matter how much money they had and what level of education and how much they looked and sounded German, they were still all sent away. So assimilation does not necessarily mean security. Liberal Judaism has become less and less assimilated over time. So we've included more and more Hebrew in our services. Originally, it was taken out. Originally, they tried to make it so the services were on Sundays, because they were actually trying to create Judaism in the image of 19th century German Protestant Christianity. And so that's why it's really easy for us to share churches with the synagogue, is because we all are also sitting in chairs looking forward at a bima, at an altar, in the same way, because that's the way it was designed for Judaism in the 19th century. So liberal Judaism does not necessarily follow Jewish law, what Orthodox Judaism does. And so I'm going to sort of take you through the life cycle of a Jewish person and point out differences where if you're growing up Orthodox, it might look like this, but if you're growing up in a liberal Jewish household, it might look like this. So you're born, okay? You're a little baby. And if you're Orthodox, if you're a boy, you're going to have a circumcision on the eighth day. A ritual circumcision, and it's not just the medical procedure, but it's a ritual performed by a moel who's a ritual circumciser. If you're liberal, you may or may not have a ritual circumcision, and you may or may not have a baby naming. But the people who choose not to ritually circumcise sometimes will have a baby naming anyways. Most people, though, do choose to ritually circumcise. But I do want to let you know that some liberal American Jews don't. As you grow older, if you're Orthodox, you're going to go to a Jewish day school, and your education is going to be exclusively within Orthodox Jewish religious schools. But if you're a liberal Jew, you might send your child to, you most likely will send them to public school or to a private school of your choice, not a religious school. Yes.
Sorry, you often now refer to liberal American Jews.
Yes.
Is the liberal Jewish tradition worldwide, or is it mostly focused here?
There is a World Union for Progressive Judaism, and so they call it progressive. This means the same thing outside of the United States. And we're all connected, but it's much, much smaller around the world. There's also very small Jewish populations, but it's much smaller there. So in terms of the schooling would be very different. Camps would also be like Orthodox camps. And because you would keep kosher, you'd keep the dietary laws, it meant that you wouldn't necessarily be able to go over to a friend's house to eat who wasn't Jewish. So the laws, the way they're practiced, keep the community very, very tightly knit. While a liberal Jewish child would most likely go to public school, have friends of many different backgrounds, and probably does not keep kosher. If they do keep some kind of kosher, I call Reform kosher because the largest liberal denomination is Reform Judaism. It means they don't eat pork. Maybe they don't eat like beef and dairy together. But that's it. While people who keep kosher would not eat any place where the food wasn't prepared kosher, in addition to a lot of other injunctions. So the education would be different. Both liberal and Orthodox boys and girls, to a greater extent, in both communities become b'nai mitzvah when they're 13 or 12 and a half, and the children become, that's when you become an adult. So even Orthodox are like doing some kind of ceremony often to recognize the daughters, even if they're not reading from the Torah and doing everything that a bar mitzvah would do. And then you would, in Reform and Liberal Judaism, they decided they wanted to take confirmation from Christianity, so we added in at 16 confirmation, which I think is interesting. They tried to do away with bar mitzvah because they thought they were too young, and 16 made more sense, but everybody wanted to keep 13, and then 16 stuck, so now we have two coming-of-age rituals in high school and middle school. Confirmation and bar and bat mitzvah. But it's fun to hear them speak about their identity development twice in their youth years. And then when you go to college, many modern Orthodox Jews will send their children to universities and colleges, but in those universities, they would have a large Hillel, which is the Jewish organization. They would have a separate cafeteria, separate prayer spaces. They would be taken care of. And liberal Jews would sort of go wherever, also look for a Jewish community, but it would not necessarily be the top of their choice of like where they're going to go to school. Both communities really push college. I would say that's that's common, is that education is a big push. There's sort of there's two options. You can go to college or you can go to Israel. That's sort of the, like, go there and work the lands. Like, that's sort of the other idea. Then in terms of getting married, if that's something that people choose, in Orthodox Judaism, you would not intermarry. If two people fell in love and the person who wasn't Jewish wanted to marry them, they would have to convert, and they would have to convert Orthodox. So they would have to show that they are living according to the laws. In terms of liberal Judaism, you know, we're at 50% intermarriage throughout liberal Judaism. So 50% of American Jews marry someone who's not Jewish, and sometimes they raise their families as Jews in the Jewish community, sometimes they don't. It really depends on where they are, and many, many different factors. So there's marriage. Now, what becomes really interesting is end of life. As someone who is like now rabbiing, this is sort of the word I made up, like pastoring to people who, as they're getting older, who either intermarried and didn't connect to community or just felt like community wasn't that important to them. At the end of their life, they want a rabbi. And I know, at the end of their lives, they want to connect to community, they want a rabbi, they want to know, they want to think about where do I want to be buried and how do I want to be buried. And so we're sort of seeing that towards the end of life, I mean, in the Orthodox community, there's a whole network to take care of people. There's like community homes and daycare. And then the liberal community has that, but to a lesser extent. But I am finding that at the end, and closer to the end of life, like, lots of people are wanting to connect, no matter what their trajectory was in terms of their Jewish identity. So that's sort of the main difference between Orthodox and liberal Judaism. Under Orthodox, you might see modern Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, Hasidic. So modern Orthodox, you can often tell by the yarmulkes, they wear something like this, while ultra-Orthodox might be wearing like a big black hat. So there's different, often the headwear that gives indications of what the sect is within the denomination. Liberal Judaism, we have Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Renewal. They're all basically shades of the same color. We all accept LGBTQ people, perform weddings, and ordain. We all accept interfaith families. We're all, you know, all those denominations are pro-choice in terms of that, you know, just in terms of the social issues, work for immigration reform, have a very progressive agenda, and have actually the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism, where we have paid lobbyists in Washington, D.C., that are part of all the different coalitions of religious groups that work on different social issues through legislation. So liberal Judaism is very active. And I say Orthodox Judaism is not that active politically, but because of the Trump-Israel alliance, they're becoming more politically active. But it's not their inclination. I think that Adam was saying that in Islam, you have to follow the laws of the land around you, and we have the same law, where like you have to follow the laws of the land around you. You can't say, like, well, I'm just not going to follow these civil laws because of my religious law. But there is also no rule that says you need to get involved with civil society. So any questions about life cycle and denominations? Yes?
What's the general mix, like in the U.S. and then global, to Orthodox to liberal progressive?
I would say it's probably like 70% liberal progressive, not affiliated, just Jewish, and 30% like actual Orthodox. And they're much more visible because they dress in a distinctive way, but it's not the majority.
That's U.S. and global as well.
And global,
same type of race,
yeah. And Israel's pretty split. You know, it's not the vast majority of people there are not religious. But the Orthodox, because it's based on the English government system of having a parliament, they can form coalitions. And so the religious have formed a coalition with the political right, and that's how they get a majority. And just the way they're able to make a majority out of enough little groups that they can put it together. But, you know, they're always at risk of their government falling apart at any second because they're majority, you know, it's just, they're very fragile coalitions.
I just want to ask, so liberal Jews seem really progressive, but do they not overall start kind of feeling like they're going too far away from their traditional Jewish heritage, or where is that line, and how can we navigate really like really hard texts to this extent?
Yeah. Well, I think it's not as much of a conversation because Judaism is such a heavy baggage to carry. But it's pretty easy for people to just be like, I'm putting it down and walking away. Like, and so there's actually a story, I don't think it's actually true, but that if you go to the bottom underneath the Statue of Liberty, that you'll find, like, yarmulkes and the phylacteries, these straps that are for religious observance, and all their Jewish things that they just dumped off the boat. So when they got off the boat, they didn't have the burden of the religion. So they could be free because they have a negative association because they'd be like, oh, we can just be white people here. Like, we can, you know, so, hey, that's so much easier than being Jewish. So a lot of people changed their names and became not Jewish. It's very easy to do that. But people come back. And I think, I believe there's a concept that we have called teshuva. And it means to return. But it also means to repair. And I see that there's opportunities within our society for repair of broken places within the Jewish family where people walked away and sometimes come back and find healing. Sometimes they don't. Also, people, especially as millennials, are looking for ritual and they're looking for rootedness. They're looking for culture. They're looking for culture. They're looking for color in their lives. And the one thing that's really awesome about Judaism is that we have a lot of celebrations and holidays. And so when the world gets dark, I'm like, we were made for this, you guys. We were made for dark times. We know how to do this, okay? This is how you do it. Every single Friday, Saturday is a holiday. It's a celebration. It's, you take off your dirty clothes and you just, clean up and you have a beautiful meal. It's going to be the nicest meal you have of the week and the one you put the most energy into. And you sit down as a family and then the next day, you just rest and you don't work. You just don't do things that are work and you allow yourself to renew and revive. So that's kept us alive. We have actually a quote in our prayer book from 19th century Jewish philosopher that says, more than Jews have kept the Sabbath, it's the Sabbath that's kept the Jews alive. And I really believe that's true. That without this ritual of shining those lights on Friday night, and I make my congregation aware of it every single Friday night as we gather around. Imagine throughout space and time, we've come to this place every Friday night for thousands and thousands of years through times that are much harder than they are now. And this light has always given us light. So Friday night, Saturday, but we also have, and I'm going to go through them quickly, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah is our new year, and again, we're going to be starting year 5779. That's followed by our Day of Atonement, where we figuratively send two goats out into the wilderness, one with the sins of the people, one towards God, but it's our day of giving up our sins, apologizing, vowing to do better. We have the Feast of Tabernacles, where we build booths and sit in them for a week and eat our food there and celebrate and empathize with what it's like to be a refugee, what it's like to be homeless, what it's like to wander. And we go to Simchat Torah, which is a holiday where we just celebrate the Torah itself. And we unroll the whole scroll throughout the whole room so we can see the whole thing opened up. And we read the very end and the very beginning. And that's the point of the year where we start reading weekly from Genesis through the whole scroll throughout the year. Then we celebrate Thanksgiving like everybody else, which is awesome. I don't know if everybody celebrates, but we do. Hanukkah, which is a story of the Maccabees, winning back the temple, rededicating it, Festival of Lights. We have a tree holiday in February, a mystical tree holiday where we celebrate trees and we eat things from trees and talk about trees and we plant trees. And then we go to Purim, which is a celebration of the Book of Esther. We dress up and recreate that story. Passover, the story of our liberation from being slaves in Egypt to being free people, as told in dinner theater. And then we have Shavuot, which is, what's it called in the Christian tradition? Pentecost. And that's 49, 50 days right after Passover, so we do the counting. And that's when we remember the moment at Sinai of receiving Torah. Because it was during the barley harvest, and also when there were a lot of baby cows around, we also eat a lot of dairy at that holiday. So that's when we eat blintzes, cheesecake, and cream cheese, and lots of more cream cheese.
Keep talking about food.
Exactly. And then we don't have any holidays until August, when we have Tisha B'Av, which is the day we remember the destruction of the first and second temples. And also we also tacked on the expulsion from Spain, the Inquisition to that too, and the Holocaust, the sort of great catastrophes in our tradition, and that's a fast today in August. And that's the whole calendar.
Wow.
How'd we do? We still have a little bit of time, you guys.
That's
do
incredible.
We?
Yeah, you do.
So do you have any questions? We have time for a few questions.
Coming back to the Messiah's division back then, the Christians have the second coming, the Judaism, how does the first coming fit in right now?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time we spoke about sort of, well, there's a lot of stories about Elijah the prophet being the forecomer of the Messiah coming. And so basically we have all kinds of stories that anybody at any time could be Elijah. Someone could walk onto this property and could be Elijah. And that when we all behave as we should towards a stranger, that's when we know. Then Elijah's like, okay, we're ready. And we don't know what that's going to look like, that messianic era. It could be an era. It could be a person. It could be a lot of things. We've just decided that we're focusing on that everything leading up to the Elijah the prophet saying this is the time of the heralding of the coming of Messiah. Like everything that needs to be done there is what we're really into as a people. And stories about the Messiah are sort of for the purposes of encouraging us to do all that stuff. which is all the good works that could lead to the Messianic era. And I think the thinking is that rationally, if you don't believe in any, you know, anything, you could be an atheist. If you do all those good things, what's going to happen to our world? It's going to become the place that we envision. So it's win-win-win-win. We all win, yes.
And I hear from what you're saying, that's where you draw your hope.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That is where you draw your hope, the vision of the lion and the lamb. And we end our prayer services, all of them, with the prayer that on that day God's name will be one. Not that everybody's difference is wiped out, but that we will all honor each other with full dignity, that we will see divinity reflected in each other. I think it's possible. I think we can do it, so... Yes.
Maybe related to that, especially after the Holocaust. I mean, what kind of pressures, you know, both liberal and orthodox, pressures or consciousness is there of wanting to grow as, you know, in terms of population?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not that much. In the Orthodox world, there is. Like, you have as many children as you possibly can. But that's considered a mitzvah, a commandment to be fruitful and multiply, with a consciousness towards replacing lost souls from the Holocaust. Liberal Jews, which are the majority, we're not replacing ourselves. Just in terms of the sociology of the community, very highly educated, not having a lot of babies. But lots of people are interested in converting to Judaism, which is interesting. You know, we have like a lot, my Torah studies and services are full of people who are interested in converting. A lot of women in their 20s and 30s, not for marriage, just on their own. And, you know, we're not, in Judaism, you're supposed to turn someone away three times before you say, I'll even work with you. And I don't actually do that. What I say is, I'm not going to go after you. If you want to make appointments with me, if you want to see me, if you want to be part of this community, it requires you showing up regularly, becoming part of the community, making appointments with me and keeping them. And, you know, the majority actually don't do that. They're not interested really in pursuing it. I think that's why we have the three-time thing. But those who do are really committed and want to go through the whole process. So just basically a year of living through as though you were Jewish for a year, studying with me. Then you actually get a tribunal of three rabbis who ask questions about an essay that they've written. They also take on a new name, a new first name, that they can use either as their first name or just another name. And they become, say they took on Miriam, daughter Lot of Abraham and Sarah. So their official name is daughter of Abraham and Sarah. One last one, yes. Oh, I'm sorry, was that up here?
No, I just threw that in.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead here and here, yes.
Birthright the attempt to get people to be indoctrinated into Israeli Judaism.
Yeah, I mean, it's really...
I don't know what that is even.
Yeah, Birthright is, it's funded by the Brockman family of Seagram's wine coolers. They made a lot of money in alcohol. And so they fund this program called Birthright, which is that everybody who is has some kind of Jewish heritage, mother Jewish, father Jewish, grandparent, can go on this like free 10-day trip to Israel. And I know these 10-day trips. I've led 10-day trips with the guides, and they are like propaganda trips. They don't tell the full story. Very similarly to if someone took someone on a tour of the United States, they would not, there's a history they tell. And they don't always tell the full history. You could go to a tour of Washington State and Seattle and hardly mention Native Americans, if you choose to. So, yes, those are, you know, those kinds of trips. Now, what I tried to do a few years ago is become, they were trying to train rabbis like myself to go on those Birthright tours to be the facilitators of that information and that conversation. So that when we're on the bus, we can actually talk about it and process it and have a way for them to work through the information. And I think it's just, it's too politically tense. Like, it just didn't work. It's just, you know, everything is very, there's just a lot of propaganda out there all over the place. There's just a lot of propaganda, and people can't have an expansive way of teaching something or presenting an issue. So there are, I mean, I've led trips to Israel that are not on the propaganda front. And those are beautiful and painful trips.
Yeah.
And I think that they're the best way to see it. It's also the best way to see our country, is to not see it through just the lens of the Europeans over here. That would be an incomplete trip.
We went with a group called Green Olive, which is both Palestinian and Jewish Israeli, and we spent half our time on the West Bank and about half our time in Israel. So we really did see and stayed with Palestinian people in Bethlehem, and I would recommend that kind of experience.
Absolutely. There's some really, really great tours and interfaith trips that we can do that are amazing. Did we have one last question?
I was wondering about the cap.
Oh, the yarmulke.
Where and why?
So I think, you know, the Pope wears one too, as do other people in, you know, in Christian religious traditions. And I think the original symbol is it's a sign of respect for God, and that the sort of underwriting spiritual lesson within the Jewish tradition is that you remember that you stop here and the rest of the universe is out here. You always remember your place in creation, and that also because it's a symbol of being Jewish, that people are aware, like, you're a Jew in this world, so you're going to reflect on the rest of your people and your actions. Traditionally, women covered their hair and men would wear a yarmulke or a skull cap, and I wear this just when I'm working. Well, thank you so much for coming and learning about Judaism.